Sword Radio.
This war will only help the right-wing and fascist forces inside Iran. I mean, we've been against the Islamic regime in Iran. We have many communists and socialists. We have to stand against this war, the socialists and labor forces all over the world against this aggression. And we have to cry and to demand to stop this war immediately.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down.
Good morning, and welcome to another Working Week. This is KPFK's Working Voices. I'm your host, Joe Ayala, president of NABIT CWA Local 53.
And I'm your co-host, Kristen Parker, with the Montebello Teachers Association.
And in this morning's show, Steve Zeltzer's labor video brings us an interview with Samal Ali, a leader of the Worker Communist Party of Iran Hekamist. Enrique Sanchez from Spanish United has an interview with Temple City Council candidate Kumar Swaminathan. Peter Ross interviews and presents in their own words with congressional candidates Angelica Gonzalez. And with the latest Working Voices update. All this and more coming up this morning on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. This is Working Voices.
In our first offering this morning, Steve Zeltzer from his Labor Video YouTube channel interviews Samal Ali, a leader of the Worker Communist Party of Iran Hekmatist. He talks about why all working people must oppose the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and why it is connected to the fight against global fascism and government.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek. The war of the United States and Israel on Iran is not new. The United States has been collaborating with Israel to attack the people of Iran and the government of Iran for decades. And in fact, the United States was involved in the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953 to protect U.S. oil interests in the Middle East. And now you have a regional war that's developing with the United States bombing Iran and with the support of Israel, and also wars breaking out throughout the Middle East. This is a threat to the working class in the world. And joining us is Samal Ali. He is a leader of a working class organization, and he has been organizing against the war and also for workers in Iran and around the world to oppose this war. He's with the Worker Communist Party of Iran, Hekmatist. So welcome to our show, Samal.
Thanks very much. Thank you for having me.
So, Samal, why don't you talk first about your position leading up to this war? Because I know your organization, although it's opposed to the Iranian government, has said that you were opposed to the war and the attack by the United States on Iran.
Exactly, because we are facing maybe another scenario, another Iraqi scenario that we've seen what's happened with Iraq. I mean, this time is a little bit different. The United States is only attacking, bombing, actually not with the military with the boots on the ground, as they say. However, it's only about more chaos, sectarian or ethnic, or maybe the same scenario has happened in Iraq is about to happen in Iran. I mean, the people in Iran is against the current regime, capitalist Islamic Republic of Iran. And they actually have struggled for 47 years. They never gave up. to protest against all the oppressions and bourgeois imperialist power in Iran. But actually, it's this war will only help the right-wing and fascist forces inside Iran, and this will turn the society. I mean, actually, it will break down the very social fabric in Iran. I mean, people will be afraid, and they will run for their lives instead of struggling for more freedom and equality. And that's why we've been against the Islamic regime in Iran. We have many communists and socialists and working labor activists has lost their life in the struggle against this regime. But when it's coming to a war like the fascist war of Israel and United States against Iran, we cannot have other than a very condemned position. Or I mean, we have to stand against this war, and we have to be as well as all the socialists and labor forces all over the world against this aggression. And we have to cry and to demand to stop this war immediately.
And of course, the fascist government of Trump is just invaded, attacked Venezuela. They want to attack Cuba. They also are aiming at China and stopping oil from Iran. What is going to be the effect on the Middle East and the world with the destruction that's taking place by Israel and the United States in Iran and the Middle East?
I mean, the outcome is clear. I mean, 2 days ago, the Reza Pahlavi, the guy that United States want to appoint as their leader, as a king, and to bring back the monarchy in Iran, is the person that should, to take his father's place in Iran. Has called the military to attack Kurdish people and all the people who demand some kind of freedom or maybe self-determination inside Iran. And this only show you that what's happening in Iran in future is another fascist regime. And this time it will be with support of United States and Israel. I mean, Israel and United States will want to have control in the Middle East. And not only an foreign control or imperialist control. They want to control the people, like to impose their fascist ideas about human rights and that type of freedom that they call for, it, which is freedom of capitalists and freedom of the capitalist class, not for people. It's that way they want to impose on Middle East, but actually the outcome will not even be that be a stable region under this type of control. I mean, the region will be, as I said, we can see the same scenario that happened in Iraq in a very large scale. Now, Iran is about 80 million people, and there is many forces supported by different reactionary and different dictatorship in the region, and fascists in the region, like Pakistan, like Saudi Arabia, like Israel, even Turkey. To make a chaos in Iran and turn it to a battlefield when everybody fighting everybody. I mean, this is the scenario that's coming about. I mean, this is, but it's not inevitable. I mean, people still in Iran have a long history of struggling for freedom and equality. There is a very strong labor movement, and even it's not illegal, but there is some type of organization among workers and laborers, and this will have to, and they cannot do anything other than standing against this situation and try to organize themselves and fight back for their freedom and humanity. And the situation is very dangerous. It's not dangerous only for the Middle East. I mean, this type of aggression, that will be the new international law. If you have power, you can do whatever you like, whatever you need. That type of international law that we had before, it was a part of a package which contained, some type of human rights too. But now we are facing a situation where all this will be made something in past, and we might find ourselves in the 19th centuries like capitalism, when people should work like slaves and without any rights. I mean, this is not a threat against Middle East only. It's a threat against the world, and even the labor class in United States will face that situation. This is to impose slavery on labor class in United States. We have to look at it like that, and that's why the labor class in United States and all over the world should be part of this struggle to support Iranian people, to support working class in people, to impose to be against the war, and at the same time to have solidarity with the Iraqi people, with Iranian people against their brutal regime too.
The Zionists have a big influence in the United States. Netanyahu's come to the U.S. Congress many times and attacked the American people for opposing the Israeli suppression of repression and genocide of the Palestinians, and now the bombing of many other countries in the Middle East. The project of Israel in supporting the Iraq war, there was a committee called the Committee to Liberate Iraq with George Shultz, American capitalist. He was head of Bechtel at one time. It seems that U.S. imperialism and the fascist government of Trump now are aligned with the Zionist project and expanding Israel's power and its control of the Middle East. Is that what is going on?
I mean, whatever was our position against Zionism, I mean, myself, I'm not, I have been against that movement all of my life, but what we see in Israel is more than that. Like you can call it Zionism 2.0. I mean, something that is more fascist and more brutal than even the type of reactionary movement which we've been seeing, the catastrophic of their deed in Palestine and Middle East. I mean, Israel were back in the reactionary, the despotic government in Middle East, and they were against all the left and freedom-loving people in this region. But this what we've seen in this this time, in this period of time, is more than that. Is actually a fascist force that want everybody to see how it's legal and justified to kill children, thousands of children. And they streamed live to everybody. I mean, whenever you are about to see an image from Palestine, a part of your humanity is dying. That's what we see in Middle East, and that's what we facing now. I mean, this that we can call Israel and what they're doing in Gaza and in Palestine like a laboratory for fascism all over the world. They want to let people be new normal, which is normal to kill people just because they not belong to your race, and in brackets and to your religion or to your ethnic group, is justified in that ideology. I mean, the fascist government of Trump supporting Israel because they are of the same kind, and they what they want to bring about, it's not a secret. They really, if you ask tech billionaires in Silicon Valley, they will tell you that democracy is past. That we don't need democracy anymore. We need a monarchy. We need a king, and Trump should be, president for life, and they should have the power, and they will not allow another kind of capitalist like in Democratic Party to come to power again. This is what they plan to find. I mean, this war in Iran is a war. How you can call it the war against humanity? It's not only against the labor class, but the labor class is the only force that can stop them and actually force them to set back.
And of course, the working people of the United States, the working people of the world, will pay for this war, the inflation, the cost of this war, and also, what is going to be the situation in Europe with the European imperialists? Because they have bases as well, and they have been supporting the United States. They've allowed the United States to use military bases throughout the world. Is there going to be a movement in Europe against this U.S.-Israeli war?
I think if it's, people sometimes is in shock when they find this type of aggression, but if this continues like for longer time, then we will see a reaction among working labor class and the freedom loving people even in Europe, because when you speak about Europe. Europe is not one entity. Europe is a plus society. I mean, like any part of the world. And here we have even the fascist and Nazist forces that want to use this type of aggression in order to impose a new type of Nazism in Europe too. And that's why the people in Europe, as we will, sometimes the pressure of the propaganda against migrants and against people from Middle East who came to Europe, but this will be clarified in future, and I think that there is no other option than going against this type of aggression. I mean, we live in a very, very dark age now. We are stepping forward toward a more dark age if we not stand and not stand together all over the world. That we don't take. International solidarity should not only be about messages and letters and statements here and there. It should be a force on the ground. The people should force those brutal bourgeoisie that they want to take all of us back to 200 years, 2 centuries back to that situation of 2 centuries ago. We will have to stand together against this type of aggression. I see this aggression in Iran like only a part of that attempt to impose slavery on the working people all over the world.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much. We've been talking with Shamal Ali. He is with the Worker Communist Party of Iran. Hikmatist, and he's been talking about the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran and the effect on the working people, the minorities, and also why American workers have to oppose this war in action and stop this imperialist intervention. So I want to thank you again for joining us, Shamal.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
That was Steve Zeltzer from his Labor Video YouTube channel. For more videos and insights from Steve Zeltzer, you can go to his Labor Video YouTube channel, or now you can find him at the Production of Labor Video Project on the web at labormedia.net. How will you see the end of the land of the brave and the free? It doesn't fall fast, it fades out slow.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. You're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio, KPFK, in Los Angeles.
In our next offering for this early Monday morning, Working Voices welcomes contributor Pete Ross to the team, who brings this In Their Own Words exclusive from Angela Gonzalez, who is running for Congress in California's 34th District.
Angela Gonzalez Torres. I'm a lifelong Angeleno, Chicana anthropologist, running to represent the heart of Los Angeles in Congress, California's 34th Congressional District, currently being held by Jimmy Gomez, and happy to be here today. I'm the daughter of a deportee, and even having lived through my own father's deportation, I still would have never imagined we would be seeing what we're seeing today. And I think that's why I feel the urgency of this moment. And so we've volunteered on past campaigns that we felt were important, specifically those calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. And when we saw that Jimmy Gomez was last cycle one of APEC's top five recipients of campaign contributions, we decided, as you know, a student-led campaign, to jump into the race and have earned the support of the Working Families Party in California and Justice Democrats as well, which is really set on taking on AIPAC, but broadly just getting corporate money's influence out of our politics so we can have a fighting chance, you know, at making sure our representatives are making community-informed decisions, which I feel Jimmy Gomez is currently not. Last cycle in 2024, after accepting nearly $3 million from AIPAC, he failed to co-sponsor the only bill calling for a ceasefire, still has not signed on to block the bombs. While Democrats and challengers across the country are rejecting AIPAC money, he's fully embracing their support. Last quarter, at the end of December, he took tens of thousands of dollars alone. We're still going through his FEC filing reports today, because AIPAC is now, and AIPAC affiliates and supporters, of sending more military aid and funding to Israel, are kind of putting their money in other ways, in other, you know, PACs. Additionally, you know, after accepting nearly $500,000 from the crypto lobby, you know, Jimmy Gomez voted to further Trump's corrupt crypto agenda, and that's something that we're keeping an eye on as well, with the expansion of AI data centers. Thank you. Yeah. So I think additionally, we're not just running this, you know, pro-peace campaign and really one that makes sure that we're abolishing ICE, but one of our researchers on the campaign saw that our top three issues in this district are, you know, we have the highest cost of incarceration as well. If you look up Million Dollar Hoods, some of our neighborhoods resisting advanced gentrification are those with some of the highest costs of incarceration per neighborhood, including a lot of wrongful convictions. So this is also a campaign that we work with formerly incarcerated and system impacted students like myself. And then also Dirtiest Air in all of LA County, and which I'm feeling today, particularly you can hear my voice. And then we're constantly grappling with some of the largest amounts of eviction notices issued in the entire city. So those are the three things that we're looking at. And so when you look at Jimmy Gomez's top three campaign contributors, it being this APAC the crypto lobby, but also corporate real estate developers, we think that we need a representative that not only reflects the courage of our people, as we're seeing today at this demonstration in front of City Hall, but one that will make sure they are not profiting from those, you know, corporations perpetuating our pain here. When we feel as people that we have nothing left to lose, you know, like myself, I feel like I did everything right. I went to pursue higher education to bring that knowledge back home to fight for working families like my own, and I still have to work two jobs, you know, to keep a roof over my head. And so something's fundamentally wrong. And so when we feel like we have nothing left to lose, I feel that we have everything to gain. And so we're seeing that in people building people power, getting more informed, and naturally getting more involved to protest these you know, data centers, and that really just suck our resources out of our neighborhoods. And the particularly AI and crypto lobbies really destabilize communities that are predominantly Black and brown, and so, and exploit our workers. And so we're just inviting people as a campaign rooted in education. I work at Pasadena City College and work really well with Lalo Vargas, another candidate who mobilizes particularly high school students around just getting more informed and getting more involved. And our campaign is one where, you know, we're really excited that people have chosen this to support or to store their hope right now. You know, where there's a lot of different issues, but we're really doing our job to make sure people don't feel like they're all single issues. They're all really connected in corporate greed and the exploitation of our communities. 70% or 7 out of 10 voters, you know, were polled that we just don't want more endless wars. And we definitely don't want particularly U.S. military action in Iran right now. And so right now we are really struggling, like I said, to make sure that we're making community-informed decisions. And we're here particularly to call on Congress to you know, bring a vote and to the war powers resolution in question right now. It really does feel like, you know, I was hanging out with some students today and my family members this morning, and the energy is very interesting because it feels very hopeful in our communities and in our classrooms and in my household, you know, where generationally we've been fighting for this moment where it actually feels like we can do something about this. A student in our program said it feels like this state-sanctioned violence that we've all been forced to live under is at the front doors of many Americans right now and many Angelenos, and it feels like our time to shine is his words, and that we can actually do something about this. So we're proud to stand with our neighbors in calling for equity and justice. And yeah, I'm trying to do, like I said, this is my contribution to unseat one of APAC's top five recipients of campaign contribution.
That was a Working Voices in Their Own Words exclusive from congressional candidate Angela Gonzalez, brought to us by contributor Pete Ross. For more information about Angela Gonzalez, you can find her on her website at angelaforcongress.com.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona.
Know what's on your mind happens all the time. Could we all work it together? You're not by yourself.
In In our next segment, Enrique Sanchez from Spanish United Radio interviews special guest Kumar Swaminathan, who is running for Temple City City Council.
Welcome to Spanish United Radio. I'm your host, Enrique Sanchez. We have a very special guest. Would you be kind enough to introduce yourself to the audience?
My name is Kumar Swaminathan, and I'm a longtime resident of Temple City. I've lived here for the past, I would say, 27 years. I'm running for the city council.
So explain a little bit about your run for office, a little bit of your background. What would you like to see Temple City improve in?
I'm an immigrant. I immigrated from India in the early 1980s. By education, I'm an engineer. I was educated back in India with degrees in computer science and electronics engineering. And then I came to the U.S. To pursue my master's degree in computer science. And then I went on to do my MBA as well. And for the first 20, 25 years of my life in the US, I was working for various Fortune 500 multinational companies. I manage large budgets that spans not just states, but different countries. So I gained a lot of experience along the way. Like I said, having lived in Temple City for the past 25 years, a couple of things happened that led me to this situation, right? Of course, there is a seed inside me that wanted me to run for a public office, that always been there, but I never acted on it, either because I was not ready or the opportunity didn't exist. So that seed was there, and everything lined up maybe in late October, November of last year. And what happened was I kind of realized that, hey, you know, in my life, I'm well settled. The kids are grown up and they're doing great. Our business is doing great. My health is good. Everything is good around me. And I also reached a stage in my life, okay, now what do I do next? I'm not planning to retire, but how do I keep myself busy and contributing? I love to contribute, right? And then the first thing that struck me was, wow, Temple City didn't have an election for a council member for the past 10 years. Then I made a decision, okay, let me go file my paperwork. And the city clerk, she's extremely helpful. The city itself, I'm talking about the career employees. And they walked me through the process, and here I am. And ever since I filed the nomination in December, it's been a great experience. So I had a few town hall meetings. I knocked on doors, I handed out flyers and everything, and I was mostly listening to people. They said that they felt so disconnected from the city. It's like they don't know who the mayor is, they don't know who the council members are, and they were not proud of being part of Temple City, many of them.
As much as we may not like it or like think about it, politics affects the lives of people, and whatever decision the leaders make, regardless if it's a good one or a bad one, depends on how we vote, and at the same time depends on what we know. So it's always very important for the people to be engaged with their local leaders, and for local leaders to be engaged with the population, particularly with the public, because they are the ones that are paying the salary for the public servant to serve the community at large.
Exactly. That's not an issue. The problem is the lack of willingness. Instead, I go to these council meetings, it's always empty.
Right.
It's because, you know, there is a gap between the city hall and the citizens already. So how do you expect anybody to show up in the city hall council meetings? Instead, one of the first things that I will do, let's have a mobile council meetings where we go to the communities in the evenings or the weekends. Let's pick communities where we can sit like in a mobile units and talk to them in their language if it needs to be, and ask them, hey, we are your elected leaders. How can we help? What are you facing? Without that, anything that happens at the city hall is done in vacuum, right? You know, so they're just making up what's priority for the city and just spending our money as they wish. So that's number one.
Right.
Number two, I really feel that the diversity in Temple City is an asset. So we have Hispanic, Asian, different types of Asians, European, white, black, and everything, right? But you still don't get that community cohesiveness that transcends above all this. Not an opportunity that brings people together from multiple cultures. See, I come from a culture where we gather around festivals. And like that, we would celebrate, you know, Islamic, Hindu, Christian, any festival, because people are already in their celebratory mode. They come together and then they coalesce and gather around and have fun, and they get to know each other, and that's how you build the community.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with Singapore, but Lee Kuan Yew, the first prime minister, one of the things that he did when he was elected into office is that he did similar what you're proposing, is that he would go directly into the neighborhoods, the town squares, even the apartments of the people, talk to people directly, let it be through English or Chinese or a translator, and then getting people to be more involved. And I think that helped to make a more harmonious society, because Singapore, as you know, even though it's a majority Chinese country, It is a multicultural, multi-religious, multilinguistic, and multi-ethnic society, but it's also very prosperous. So that could be an example that you could use to bring people to be more involved in the city, Temple City.
You got it. Exactly. Right. Yes.
And I think, you know, for any public servant that is running for public office, it's very important that one has to listen to the concerns of the citizens, and if they are to raise taxes, even if it's by 5% or 5 cents, for example, you know, there has to be, you know, guaranteed that they will see benefits, because that's the reason why a lot of people don't want to vote, because people say, what's the point of voting if they're not doing anything to make my quality of life better or to lower my taxes or to raise my taxes, but give me some type of trade-off on the long run.
I mean, yeah, we all get it that taxes are needed. That's how your community is taken care of by the government entity, right? There's got to be, number one, transparency, and number two, buy-in from the citizens, right? What that means is, like, you know, if you ask the average Temple City citizen, I doubt if many people would even know what this tax is all about and how that tax dollar is going to be spent and so on, right? Mm-hmm. And like you said, if they don't even understand what it is for, how it's going to make their life a little bit better, how do you expect them even to vote yes or no, right?
Yesterday, I was in St. Gabriel, where I was speaking on behalf of Spanish United, because right now, many of the Hispanic people feel that they're invisible and they're heavily being persecuted by ICE. So again, as a public official, you know, they need to listen to the concerns of the Hispanic community, because even though the Hispanic community may not be economically well off as others, but they contribute heavily to the economy.
Not just the economy. See, I see this Hispanic community is literally a backbone of Southern California, right? Mm-hmm. How can we leave this community behind? How could we stand by and see that community go through this harassment and all that in out there in the street? So that will definitely be one of my priorities.
Yes, because I feel that if the Hispanic community is totally subdued or they are expelled, it will be detrimental to the economy, not just only for Temple City, but also for the entirety of the United States. So the majority of them are honest working people that want to live the American dream. They want to provide for their families, and they contribute a lot. And I feel that it's very important that they should be respected and treated with dignity like every other group of people, regardless if one is wealthy or not, because what does it say about us as a society?
Exactly. You know,
where we treat our vulnerable less than humanely.
You know, love thy neighbor. It's a statement that we should all live by, right? It's we don't ask love thy neighbor as long as I know where they're coming from. You know, they
don't exactly work.
Doesn't work that way, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that is the kind of outlook and space that I come from, and say, you know, I see people for who they are. There are a lot of underrepresented groups, specifically the Hispanic group, and I would definitely put a high priority in listening to them and make sure that they are taken care of.
Absolutely. And one of the concerns that many Hispanic people have primarily is the issue of housing. So, you know, one thing I would recommend to you as an up-and-coming public servant is to listen to the concerns of the community when it comes to housing. And at the same time, when it comes to public discrimination. So, you know, that's something that I know can be difficult to deal with, but I feel that, you know, with precision and patience, you know, you'll be able to have success in reaching the Hispanic community in terms of voting for you for office. And at the same time, seeing the overall stability and prosperity of the Hispanic community in the city of Temple City.
The housing is a huge issue for pretty much everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially for the working class family. You and our daughters are saying, oh, dad, mom, you know, yeah, you worked hard and you're owning this house, but they're doubting if they can afford to buy a home in Temple City.
Right.
Leave alone, you know, so many other working family, if they could even able to rent an apartment here, right? Okay, so the question then comes is, okay, can a city do something about it? I totally believe yes, okay? Pasadena has rent control. You know, I don't know if we are ready for that kind of things yet, but that's one of things that I will explore, for example, right? If we don't make housing affordable to people, especially the working class community, how are we going to portray ourselves as a community that welcomes everybody, right? Yeah, I mean, we need people from every class, every walk of life, every economic status, every cultural background, and all those. That really is what can make Temple City vibrant.
So we're coming to the end of our time, but I want to tell you, Kumar, thank you for being a guest on the show and for all the listeners listening on Spanish United Radio.
Enrique, I really appreciate you reaching out to me. I'm extremely, extremely thankful to you. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That was Enrique Sanchez from Spanish United. For more interviews, videos, and information from Enrique Sanchez, you can go to his Spanish United YouTube channel, or you can find him at the Spanish United webpage. For more information on Kumar Swaminathan, you can find his website at kumar4templecity.com. What our labor is worth, that's why we often in the days on the way to our work, and when we get there, we can't wait to be out. So let me tell you what it's about. Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
This is Working Voices Associate Producer Hal Lohr with this morning's Working Voices Update. On the education front, Los Angeles is facing a potential teacher strike amid a broader labor campaign across California. As teachers push for better pay and negotiations intensify, while California schools are facing a tense showdown as labor negotiations heat up between teachers and districts. With budget pressures mounting, staffing concerns, and the possibility of a strike looming, families and communities are watching closely. LAUSD's projected budget deficit led the Board of Education to approve sending notices of possible layoffs to about 3,200 employees, as required by California law. These notices do not guarantee job loss, but signal serious fiscal strain, claiming budget pressures are driven by declining enrollment, the phase-out of one-time COVID relief funds, and rising costs. UTLA members voted to authorize a potential strike if contract negotiations stall. This gives union leaders the legal ability to act if the district falls short with priorities that include fair wages, improved benefits, and better staffing levels. The strike authorization does not guarantee a strike, but raises the stakes in bargaining as both sides are still in discussion and union leaders emphasize keeping schools open while negotiating fair terms, even as teachers in Los Angeles face high housing, transportation, and health care costs, and many must work second jobs or live far from schools to make ends meet. So unions argue that salaries must match regional living expenses to retain staff, and negotiators aim to balance competitive pay with sustainable budgets as financial pressures remain a central concern in any LA-based labor talks. Negotiations continue with both union leaders and district officials as they prepare for potential next steps. Educators seek fair pay and manageable work conditions, and district leaders stress fiscal issues while trying to avoid work stoppages. Either way, as negotiations heat up, the outcome will affect school operations and labor relations in the coming months. And in broader AI-affected labor news, Uber has announced a new set of services to support ride-hailing for autonomous vehicles ahead of its planned launch of robo-taxis in Los Angeles in the coming months. Uber's new program, called Uber Autonomous Solutions, aims to give robo-taxi ventures easy access to Uber's customer base, software, and infrastructure. Participating companies would get access to Uber's platform, one of the most widely used ride-hailing apps in the world, as well as unique data Uber has collected from busy streets and pickup areas. Under a partnership with Volkswagen announced last year, Uber plans to offer a self-driving taxi network for shared rides that shuttles multiple passengers from plans to launch the service in Los Angeles early this year, and testing has already begun. The company said that the ride-hailing service will use autonomous electric minivans from Volkswagen called the ID. Buzz, and the effort will rely on autonomous technology from the Volkswagen-owned brand MOIA or Moya. Uber isn't new to the autonomous vehicle space. It attempted to develop its own AV, but gave up in 2020. So the company is now leaning toward a model in which other companies develop the technology for robo-taxis, and Uber makes money from them through its app. The San Francisco-based Uber is also preparing to launch a robo-taxing collaboration with Lucid, a Silicon Valley-based electric vehicle maker, and Nuro, an artificial intelligence company. The companies did not say where the robo-taxi would be first available, but said it would launch in late 2026. This month, Uber has already announced it would spend $100 million to build fast charging stations for electric autonomous vehicles in Los Angeles, in a move to further solidify Uber's commitment to the driverless robo-taxi market. Uber isn't the only one in the race to get more robo-taxis on the road, though. Waymo is among the top players in the robo-taxi industry, with fully driverless services operating in 10 major cities. Waymo arrived in Los Angeles in 2024 and announced this week its expansion into 4 new cities in Florida and Texas. The arrival of Waymo in Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, and Orlando gives the company a boost over Amazon-backed Zoox, which is still testing its robo-taxis in a handful of cities. And Waymo has logged more than 200 million fully autonomous miles on public roads so far. But many, particularly in San Francisco, still question the utility and safety of driverless vehicles, all this causing gig economy drivers to question their future even after recent efforts in California to promote unionization of Uber and Lyft drivers. In employment news, American employers unexpectedly cut 92,000 jobs last year, a sign that the labor market remains under strain as the unemployment rate blipped up to 4.4%. Hiring deteriorated from January when companies, nonprofits, government agencies all added a healthy 126,000 jobs, the Labor Department reported on Friday. Economists had expected 60,000 new jobs in February. Revisions also cut 69,000 jobs from December and January payrolls. The surprisingly weak employment picture in February adds to the economic uncertainty over the war with Iran, which has caused oil prices to surge and saddled businesses and consumers with unforeseen costs. The job market had been expected to rebound this year from a lackluster 2025 when it was buffeted by President Donald Trump's erratic tariff policies, his purge of the federal workforce, and the lingering effects of high interest rates. In 2025, employers added just 15,000 jobs a month. Hopes for a 2026 rebound rose after January hiring came in above expectations. But just when it looked like the labor market was stabilizing, this report delivers a knockdown blow to that view, said Olu Sonola, head of the U.S. economics at Fitch Ratings. It's bad news whichever way you look at it. And the job losses are widespread. Construction companies cut 11,000 jobs last month, which likely reflects frigid weather. And healthcare firms shed 28,000 jobs after a 4-week strike by more than 30,000 nurses and other frontline workers at Kaiser Permanente in California and Hawaii, where healthcare had been one of the job market's strong points. Factories cut 12,000 jobs and have now lost jobs for 14 of the last 15 months. Restaurants and bars lost nearly 30,000 jobs, administrative and support services firms cut nearly 19,000 jobs, and courier and messenger services almost 17,000 jobs. Financial firms added 10,000 jobs, though job cuts continue to hit that sector as well this year. Average hourly wages rose 0.4% from January and 0.3-0.8 from a year earlier. But the outlook for the job market and the entire economy is clouded by the war with Iran. The combination of weak hiring and increasing inflationary pressures arising from the war creates a nightmare for the Federal Reserve, which must decide whether to cut interest rates to help the job market or hold off to help keep a lid on prices. Employers were reluctant to hire last year because of uncertainty over Trump's tariffs and the unpredictable way he rolled them out. The impact of Trump's aggressive trade policies may recede in 2026. His import taxes became smaller and less erratic after he reached a trade truce last year with China and deals with leading U.S. trade partners such as Japan and the European Union. A lot of businesses have also learned how to offset the costs of those tariffs, often by passing them on to consumers via higher prices. Brian Bethune, an economist at Boston College, said that Trump's 2025 tariffs were a shock to companies' business plans. Now, just as they've adjusted to them, guess what? All of a sudden, their 2026 business plans are upended by an increase in fuel costs caused by the war with Iran. Yet, tariffs last year were not rolled out until spring or later. And finally, a little extra sunshine for working people this morning, as the share of American workers in unions edged up in 2025. The first rise in years, despite the Trump administration's attack on federal government unions and the agency that enforces collective bargaining rights. Union membership increased by a tenth of a percentage point to 10% last year because of successes in union organizing and slower labor market growth. About 14.7 million workers were union members in 2025, an increase of 410,000, according to data released by the Labor Department last Wednesday, which means the number of workers represented by unions in the U.S. rose to the highest levels since 2009. That figure, which represents workers covered by union contracts generally, is higher than union membership numbers because some workers opt out of membership in union workplaces, even though they receive the benefits of a union contract. Last year, union gains coincided with numerous actions by the Trump administration aimed at weakening organized labor's power. And it wasn't long ago that Donald Trump stripped millions of federal workers of their collective bargaining rights and canceled federal union contracts. And to try to make matters even worse, he also fired a member of the National Labor Relations Board without cause for the first time in the agency's 90-year history. So for the most part this year, the board lacked a quorum necessary to consider cases alleging violations of the National Labor Relations Act. But still, more working people are participating in unions. And that is good news for organized labor.
And that's our show for this week. And once again, we're asking our labor partners, locals, and regional offices to seriously consider underwriting this show, because Working Voices and KPFK could really use your support. So please contact the station at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org to explore the possibilities. We need to hear from you. Email your comments or questions to workingvoices@aol.com. Please contribute if you can at 818-985-5735. Once again, this is Joe Ayala, our co-host, Kristen Parker. Our thanks to Steve Zeltzer, Enrique Sanchez, Dan McCrory, Gary Scott, Peter Ross, Hal Lohr, and of course our guests. Please continue to give what you can and keep us going. We're in this together. And of course, always remember to educate, agitate, and organize. Have a great week, everybody.
Got so much work,
You never wanna be told the truth. The lies continue. The people suffer. What are we to do? The time is now. We will wait no longer. We decide right now. It's over. We have the power. We know it. We feel it. I'd
like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and especially thank those of you who pledged your support or renewed your membership to KPFK during this past fund drive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it.
Support comes from the Alex Theater, presenting the Ravi Shankar Ensemble on March 31st at 8 p.m.
Curated by Anushka and Sukanya Shankar, this debut U.S. tour celebrates the legendary Ravi Shankar's music with rare archival visuals and live performance featuring sitar, tabla, and other traditional Indian classical instruments. This will be a very special evening honoring Ravi Shankar's enduring legacy. More information and tickets are available at itsmyseat.com and kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Lonnie Jordan, founding member of the band War, and I'm a big fan of KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.